Okay, what was that experience like?
Going back, back into the dark, back into the past, a long way. We were just talking about how old the Red Lady of Haviland is. 1,500 BCE.
Yeah, BCE. That's extraordinary thing. 31,000 BCE. Yep.
So is the goat cave where the Red Lady?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So based on an actual place.
Yes, no, absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Is that the one at Port Island? Yeah.
Rosilly.
Rosilly, do you have Rosilly?
Rosilly, is it? Ah. I was there last weekend, but I don't quite know where to look.
I have been there. And you can get there along the sea bottom when the tide's right out. Unlike Neil, what's his name, who did Absalom?
Oh, Neil Oliver.
You don't have to go that way.
No. If you wait for the sea to go out, you get it. There's a more normal way to get into it. Yeah.
Is it New Slate Way? Bayway?
Sorry?
Well, it's between Port Island and Rosilly.
And Silly, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, Oxford, yeah.
Oxford, yeah. So what we're touching on here really is the very much deep time, right? So we're getting right back. So we talk about working with the anima mundi, working with the collective imagination. We really are talking about going human beings existing that far back, and what you tend to touch when you encounter that that level, that depth, really, is these great spirits, these great totemic forms, and the. What you often get are the images of female forms, great goddess figures, mammoth mothers. If we look at, I'll just share some images I've got on my computer, but some of the very early images of the mother. That's just a bit shifty. Why won't you show anything? God. Oh my God, I hate this. Where are we? Okay, fine. Somewhere. Where? Okay, so if we look, here are some sort of very early images that of the goddess figures. Not as far back as Red Lady of Babylon, but early. Does he see 6,000 BC or 31,000 BC? Now this is one of the, but this is a very early figure, 29,000. It's a drawing of a figure. And this is very, very early, Venus of Hohlfels. Carved out of mammoth ivory.
Wow.
And then the very famous, of course, Venus of Willendorf.
Where is that one?
Venus of Willendorf. It's in a German museum. Natural History Museum of Wien. Ah, there it is.
Oh, that's Vienna, isn't it?
Yeah, Vienna, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the extraordinary kind of imagery when you really contemplate that. Or you got other images, like this is a Sardinian image. Bird-like goddess, and this is a really curious fusion of the kind of the mother and the kind of cross and dagger symbol. So it's from Sardinia.
How old is that image, Ian? I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. It's about 5000 BC, I think this one. It's later, right? It's a later one. So there are some that are very early that we saw there, but they're all, these are all from what you might call what the anthropologists Magia Gambutis called old Europe. So this sense of this Neolithic, Mesolithic coming into Neolithic Europe. Way of expressing themselves, and so we, and you know, this is the territory where we get cave paintings, where we get kind of the sense of actually very, very kind of powerful and interesting kind of approach to the connected nature of things. You know, in that kind of meditation, it's just quite interesting. I mean, I knew we were going to go to that cave and have an experience there. And so what I was very interested in was the hyenas that came to greet us. And the sense of becoming a hyena. And there's a very old African tradition of the cult of the spirit hyena. You know, and these were like the guardians and guides, and take you into deep time and deep places. And then this extraordinary encounter with the mammoth mother, and the shaman guardian of the, who for me didn't speak in words at all. It was all in strange images and juxtapositions of things, but being shown a profoundly interconnected world. And this, if you like, this strata is the starting point. So when we're looking at exploring the collective imagination, looking at how the Arthurian and the Grail stories come, well, if you're going to trace the story back to its proper beginnings, well, we have to come here. And what we come to here, really, is this sense of this mysterious, magical, dangerous world with these great potent feminine deities and the figures that serve these deities as priests or messengers and we're looking really into a strata where the earth itself is perceived as alive and as divine, and where there isn't a differentiation yet between the sense of self and earth. And also, the other thing that you kind of experience at this level is the earth embedded within the cosmos. Very often what you get is a sense of going into the deep earth, into the stars, which is one of the places the hyena vision took, into the deep time, deep earth, into the stars. Now, one of the things that the aspects of our consciousness that is altered is the sense of distance. Now, if you're a Neolithic person, that sense of the stars, if you take away light pollution, the sense of the rising and the setting of the stars, the sense of the nearness of the stars is very acute. I've never ever forgotten, really, when I spent some time on retreat in South Africa. I was up in the Drakensberg Mountains, away from any light at all, and I hadn't realized how colorful the stars are. You know, we get little flashes of colour, but actually they're incredibly multicoloured. And the sense of when you're in out in the bush like that, you spend some days sleeping out in the bush and with hyenas and baboons and various other things. It was almost a literal experience of revisiting that that kind of time, really. And I was lucky enough to be able to camp out next to a very old bushman cave, which had an extraordinary image of a shaman figure and bush people dancing with a shaman. So it was quite a sacred place, I think, and sort of and to me it's one of the times I most directly encountered that kind of that sense of early existence. And in that place, the sense of the nearness of the stars and the stars being and the earth being one thing, not things that are separated by you know, light years of distance. So in a way, that's part what we tap into here, really, is in the sense of profound interconnection, profound sense of the whole interacting with the individual and the individual interacting with the whole. So rather than the sense of these ancient myths occurring out of a sense of separation, they in actual fact arise from in their origins, they arise from a sense of profound interconnectedness. I'm just going to read you a little bit from Alan Garner's book Boneland. Now, Alan Garner is a really interesting writer if we want to look at the sense of exploring deep time, because all his books really are about Alderley Edge, where he lives, and they're both about his childhood, about his life, but they're also an exploration of deep time through this one place. And he wrote a successful, very back in the 60s, he wrote a book called, two books, one called The Wizard Stone of Brisingamen, Weird Stone of Brisingamen, sorry, and another called The Moon of Gomrath. And these were kind of Tolkien-esque fantasies, but not quite, but similar, children's books, certainly, based on his on the legend that Arthur and his knights lie sleeping underneath Alderley Edge. And that, which in itself is an interesting thing, really, that particular legend of a sleeper underneath Alderley Edge, because who is this sacred figure who will kind of return? Because actually Alderley Edge is just next to Lindow Moss. And Lindow Moss is where you find the Iron Age figure of Lindow Man, who was buried in the moss, who was a kind of a sacred king figure. And so somewhere in the collective imagination, the idea that there is a sacred figure sleeping under the ground who will return to save us all, actually, you know, had a basis in fact, in that there is literally within the moss, just up the road from Alderley Edge, there was a sacred king dating from the Iron Age. Now, if we come back to Pavilion Cave for a moment, and what we see is this place, almost certainly sacred to one of the ancient goddess principle, but has entombed within it this figure who carries a staff, who has necklaces of seashells that would chime, and who has the staff is of mammoth ivory, the bracelets are of mammoth ivory, who is almost certainly a sort of priestly shamanic kind of figure, and who has been defleshed and his bones painted with red ochre. Red ochre very often used in these early times as a sacred colour connected to blood, to life, and to bringing whiteness and redness together, opposites together. So he's an example of very early example of this idea of the of these sacred figures who become sleepers within the land, who become the vehicles for the divine feminine to regenerate the, you know, to be a channel through which the sacred life comes. Now, one of the very ancient, very old tradition we're going to look at from time to time in this process is this sense of descending into the underworld to meet with sacral figures who mediate that creative kind of a life energy. And so this figure of the Red Man of Paviland is one of the oldest of these figures that we know about. But you can meet them in other places. I remember having a really powerful encounter once at a barrow, Bronze Age barrow called the Rain Barrow in Dorset, not far from Thomas Hardy's cottage. And it's not true of every old site, but some sites like this, sometimes you find these presences still there that are, because they're outside time and space, and they're performing their function of mediating that deeper life to us. And very often, when we look at places like West Kennet Long Barrow, and particularly the Long Barrows, which are more collective processes, a sense of these tombs also being shrines through which you descend into the underworld and commune with the dead who are at peace. There's a whole. We're going to explore this whole business of working with ancestral consciousness, right? Because there is the dead at peace, the dead who are in the great peace, and there are the dead who are restless. And the restless dead, in a sense, represents the people, the energies that are not at peace, that want resolution, often want revenge, often are looping on themselves. What we seek to do is to encounter what's called the blessed dead, the mighty dead, the dead at peace, who help us to connect to the deep energies of life, and whose function it is to act as guardians and mediators for that deep life, so that as we explore these different dimensions of history, living history, our task in a certain sense is to work with them to create the field of the earth peace. Now, coming back to Alan Garner, he writes these two books about which are powerful magical books, really, about the old magic wakening up again, really, and these two children. Colin and Susan encountering a wizard figure and encountering kind of other figures that both initiate them into that world, but they also help the beings of that world. And in a certain sense, that sense of the encountering of the other world, and of in that process being given to, but also giving to the other world as you do that, is right at the heart of all this practice. The sense of working with what you might call the she, the fairy beings, the elves, different terminology, is a sense of the opening ourselves to a more mysterious, more fluid world, which both gives us gifts and demands things from us, so in order that there should be interchange, and so the worlds balance each other.
No, it's very, very hard, and nothing, they will say nothing.
I don't know what's going on at the moment. It must be the elves, so sorry, that was the TV turning itself on. Right, so... was I saying? Right, yes. So there is this sense of interchange between the worlds. And one of the interesting things that that when we start to think of people, elves, fairies, spirit, they're often seen as beings that are related to us, sometimes called the cousins, sometimes called, you know, well, in Wales they're called the Twelith Teg, the good people, the beautiful people. And of course, one of the great nadirs, really, of the human imagination is when we come to the kind of 19th century where these figures get turned into flower fairies. And in a certain sense, it kind of represents the complete victory, if you like, of the linear mind over the imaginal mind. So that these great, powerful, mysterious kind of beings that have their roots in the great totems. Now, if you imagine if you're a Neanderthal man encountering a mammoth, or even encountering a pack of hyenas, actually. And so one of the things that I certainly remember from being out in the bush back in the year 2000 is, as a human being on your own, there are all these much bigger creatures around. I've had a challenging encounter with a baboon, really, which made me realize, actually, you know, back down, Ian, let the baboon have his way. He's much bigger than you are, much more dangerous. And so there's something about these numinous and powerful figures that have to be propitiated or prayed to or worked with or accommodation found with, that actually is right at the heart of this very, very early kind of tradition. And so, what we see happening, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow when we talk about what happens in the sort of beginnings of the 20th century, where the imagination starts to return, having been, in a way, almost pushed out of human consciousness. And in a way, Alan Garner in the 60s is part of that kind of movement. Following on the coattails of Tolkien, and so he's quite influenced by Tolkien, but he's got his own thing, so he writes two books. These We Are Still Embracing Our Men, and it's The Moon of Gombrath, and everybody's waiting for the third one. Now he does write the third one, but he writes the third one about 30 odd years later. Actually, it might even be longer than that. Let me see when did he write this. Oh yeah, 2012. So, in actual fact, 50 years later. So 50 years later, he writes this book called Boneland. And if you remember, you've got these two characters, Colin and Susan, who are like the famous five characters who go off and explain. But in Boneland, Susan is missing. But Colin is still there. And Colin is an eminent professor of astronomy and works nearby at Jodrell Bank, but also is a kind of a slightly mad shaman figure, still living on a hut on Alderley Edge. And part of the book involves him going into therapy with somebody. And we're never sure in the book whether Susan has vanished, because the Moon of Gombrath ends with Susan longing to accompany the daughters of the Pleiades into the other world, into the stars. And what we learn is that Susan, many years later, well, not many years, about 5 or 6 years later than the last book, goes out on her horse one day. And her horse is found on an island in the middle of a mere, and Susan's body is never found. And so we have this theme throughout Boneland of the lost sister, and a psychologically damaged Colin, who is also sort of brilliant, like a sort of autistic savant, really. And And this is counterpointed with the story of a shaman who lived on the edge and who was a Neanderthal rather than Homo sapien. And I'm just going to read you a little bit of just the beginning of this book. And the book begins really with Colin being given an injection. Listen, and he's talking to the nurse who's trying to inject you. Listen, I'll tell you, I've got to tell you. It's just a scratch, Colin. I must tell you, it's just a scratch. I will. That's done. I shall, done. Oh, done. So that's Colin. Then we segue thousands of years back to the shaman. He cut the veil of the rock. The hooves clattered the bellowing waters below him in the dark. The lamp brought the moon from the blade, and the blade, the bull, from the rock. So he has a flint blade, he's carving the rock. The ice rang, it's ice age, so there's lots of ice there. And this is at Ludchurch, further up really from where Alderley Edge is. He took life in his mouth, red pigment, spat red over hand on the cave wall. The bull roared. Around above him the trample of the beasts answered. The stags, the hinds, the horses, the bulls, and the trace of old dreams. The ice rang. He held the lamp and climbed among antlers, necks, ears, eyes, horns, haunches, the limbs, the nostrils, the rutting, the dancers, from the cave to the crack. He pushed the lamp at the dark and followed his shoulder, his head twisted through the hill, along the seam of grit, by the nooks of the dead. He slipped out, pinched the lamp, and crawled between slabs into the gash of Lud Creek on snow. The colours and the webs faded and he saw the world. The ice had dropped from the two cliffs flat in the gap. He braced himself against each side of stone and moved over the fall. He found them lying together. He tried to touch her and the child through the ice. He saw his echo, but they had no echo. Though the eyes met, they did not speak. They were not him. Where the crag had shed, spirit faces looked down from the scar, rough, knuckled and green, and grass hung over the ledges. He passed where the cleft opened more than a spear length. The sky was blue, icicles shone, the sun played, but could not reach the floor. He went along, up around, and left Lud Creek Hole by the arch to the hill. He met the footsteps, woman and child, and walked against them back above the river, cobbles banging in the melt of the summer floods, until a fold of land shut off the sound and he came to the lodge. He opened the hide and went in. He lay for 2 days, he lay for 3 days, he lay to one day more. So, what Garner is showing us there, what he's showing us very powerfully in that, is that sense of the world that the Pavilion Shaman would have inhabited. The sense of the ice that, and in the story, the woman and the child have died and been covered by the ice. And he can see them in the ice, but can't reach them. So it's very poignant and powerful. But you can hear in the language that Garner is using there, the sort of the world that we've been encountering in that meditation. Now another version we find in David Jones's poem The Sleeping Lord, which directly relates to the path. And so, and again, so this is this image of these sleepers who are in the land, who are guardians who transmit the deeper life so that things are not forgotten. And this poem is called The Sleeping Lord, and again it later relates to Arthur, but right now it's a much older figure. And is his bed wide? Is his bed deep on the folded strata? Is his bed long? Where is his bed and where has he lain him? From north of Clanmaer and Miacht, a name of double gladius piercings, south to the carboniferous vaultings of Goa. Now this is the Pavilion Cave. where in the sea slope chamber they shovelled aside the shards and the breccia, the domestic litter and man squalor of gnawed marrow bones and hearth ash, with utile shovels fashioned of clavicle bones of warm felled great fauna, these are the great beasts, donated the life signia, the crocked viatic meal, the flint-worked ivory agalba, the sacral seashell trinkets, posited with care the living amulets of gleam-white rodded ivory, these are the ivory staffs and wands, and with oxide of iron, ochred life-red, the cerements of the strong limbs of the young nobilis, the first of the sleepers of Britannia. Paudextiles, aeons and aeons before we were insulate, before we became an island. So what David Jones is pointing us here is an image of the most ancient sleeper. Here is the image of the ancient sacral king who is the servant of the mother, who is the first Mabon, son of Modron. And in, also in his poem, The Anathemata, again, he talks about the way in which we need to connect back to this ancient root. And I'll just read you a couple of excerpts of it, but again, it just reminds us of why are we doing this. The cult man stands alone in Pelham's land. Now, Pelham is the fisher king. Pelham's land is the wasted land. So it's the land, literally the land we're in at the moment, the world we're in at the moment, with war breaking up all over the place, the sense of despair, of things spoiled. So you stand, each of us in a certain sense, stand alone in Pelham's land. More precarious than he knows, he guards the signa are the signs. So these are the signs of holiness, the signs that connect us to the deep life of the universe, to the deep life of the divine. These are the stories, the images, the prayers, the practices that connect us to that deeper life. More precariously than he knows, he guards the signs. The pontifex is the bridge builder. The Pontifex Maximus was the name of the high priest of Rome. It's also one of the titles of the Pope, the one who creates the bridge. So as well as guarding the signs, we stand as the bridge, the living bridge between the worlds. The Pontifex among his house treasures, he can fetch things new and old. So again, this is a conjunction of the new and the old. We need to reach to the old, but we need to find that in new ways. So the conjunction, so the reaching back into the past, back into deep time, is to meet the dilemmas of present time. He can fetch things new and old, the tokens, the matrices. The tokens obviously are the things that remind us. They're like any token, they stimulate our memory and our attention. The matrices is a like deeper form, the matrix, the things that generate, that create. The institutes, the ancilla, the fertile ashes, the palladic foreshadowings, the things come down from heaven, together with the kept memorials, the things lifted up, and the venerated trinkets. Now this sense of then this fusion of opposites, and the new inspiration that arises with the kept memorials, the things that from the past connect us to that flow of life. You know, so there's a whole and this sense of the, and then the lifting up of things on the venerated trinket. So that sense of being connected to something that holds us, and that we can lift up into the new present set of circumstances to meet the new energy that's arising, so that these venerated trinkets are made new, and we through them are made new. This man, so late in time, curiously surviving, shows courtesy to the objects that he moves along, or handles, or puts aside the name-bearing implements. within the railed tumulus. Now, this is the image in the Anathemata is of somebody performing a mass. And this is the idea of the church or the altar being set up on a tumulus, on an ancient grave, so that there is continuity. And the railed to it's that the sense of your place, as you create the sacred place, you create a sacred space around you. So that's the rail. Within the railed tumulus, he sings high, he sings low, in a low voice, as one who speaks where a few are gathered in a high room and one gone out. Now that's a reference to the Last Supper, where they gather in the upper room, and then Judas is the person who goes out to betray Christ and to bring about the crucifixion. So one of the things we're going to find as we explore these traditions, the fusion of Christian and pagan mythology is just constant. They're not separate, they unite together in a certain way. He goes on to say, there is conspiracy here. Here is birthday and anniversary. If there is continuity here, there is a new beginning. So by remembering through time, the marks of time as well as the marks of space, we create continuity, and through continuity, we enable a new beginning. I'm going to jump a bit. In the prepared high room, he implements inside time and late in time, and are forms indelibly marked by locality and incidents. Deliberations made out of time. On this hill at a time's turn, not on any hill, but on this hill. So what he's pointing out there is that we connect to deep time, we connect to these ancient things, but we bring them into present time and space. Not any hill, but this hill. Not any time, but this time. As we bring these things together. And then what we find him doing in the poem is then recounting. So he starts to remember the beginnings of Britain, the legendary idea that the Britons come from Troy. So he's then gathering things together. Yeah, and then. Wait one sec. And then, as he gathers things together, then he goes down into an even deeper place, where he starts to talk about the human beings who create shape and form. 20 millennia, he became man, master of plastic. Who were his men, and who? And what was his house? No name yet for his mark. The master of the Venus, whose man hands God handled the Willendorf stone before they unbound the last glaciation. Oh, Europa, how long and long and long and very long again before you maze the waltz forms. It gave Vindenbona before the ramshackle last phases, or God shaped the modal rhythms for nocturnes in milk in the young time, or plot the rate and limits of the. This him at his worst, really. This is the rate and limits of the years of the city. So what he's saying there, it'll be a very long time as the ice returns. It'll be a very long time before the human capacity to create and shape the city will return again. But he says already he's at it, the form-making proto-maker, busy at the fecund image of her. Chthonic, but yes, she is the mother of us. For here it is, under the species of worked lime rock that gives suck to the Lord, she that they already venerate, her we declare, who else? And see how they run the juxtaposed forms, brightening the vaults of Lassio. That's the cave of Lassio, where you find all the find all the animals. How they do within an unbloody manner under the forms of brown hematite and black manganese on the graved lime face, what is done without far on the windy tundra at the kill, that the kindred may have life. Oh God. Oh, the academies. Now what he's describing there, he's taking us back into that primal cave, back into the creation of forms. That is the depiction of the hunt that is death and life. So I could go on, but we'll come back to him another time. Right, so what we're given are these two images of the sleeper, of the mother, of the cave, of the sleeper who is the servant of the mother, who dies for her and is at her service, and who is connected through her to the deep life of the land, to the great animals, the great totems of the land that enable life to live. And who have to die in order for life to live. Now what that starts to create over time, and again, remember we're going back 30,000 years and then moving forward, is this sense of descent into the earth, descent into the living earth that takes us into the living field of the stars, that through which we experience a sense of death and rebirth, and then of continual service to this deep energy of life, this deep creative feminine presence that keeps generating new life, and who is also the killer, who also has to consume. So we're in this cycle of life and death. The beasts kill us, we kill the beasts. We're all children of the one mother. And this sense of the mammoth mother that we encountered in the cave in the meditation is this potent kind of presence, most ancient of presences. Now, a lot of our time, what we're doing is when we sense into this territory, like David Jones, like Alan Garner, we're sensing into the remains of things. And just as we did in our meditative work, touching into then what speaks back out of that time. What, of course, we don't have is written records of that time. We have images. We have worked flint. We have ivory carvings. We have marks on walls that hint at something. But one of the things that's sort of interesting when we look at this level is all over the world the similar images appear. The animals of the hunt, the shamanic kind of figures, and great goddess figures. Now this is the underneath, the deep roots really of what later starts to appear in Welsh and Arthurian tradition as the mother and the child, later the Madonna and the Christ. But so you can see that here, and certainly the sense of the sacred king who lives and dies for the land has these incredibly deep roots. And who also is this numinous magical figure who holds the staff, who somewhere is the axis mundi of the universe, who by standing in that position, who mediates between the outer and the inner, between deep time and present time, deep space and present space, universal space and this hill. Now that's in a sense that the vocation that we are called to here. Let's read you another bit of David Jones, because I think the best thing with David Jones is I just feed and explain different bits, because he is very hard, but he does say extraordinary things. This is another poem called The Tutelar of the Place. She that loves place, time, demarcation, hearth, kin, enclosure, site, differentiated cult, though she is but one mother of us all. One earth brings us forth, one womb receives it all, yet to each she is other, named of some name other. Now this, what's been looked at here, if we go back to the Tree of Life for a moment, is this is this quality of Bina, the Divine Mother, who is the who is the shaper of all, and who loves the particularity of each shape that she creates. So it's this sense of the universal love coming into the particular form, and that differentiation being part of that joy of the creative process of the universe. Tell us of the myriad names, answers to but one name. From this tump, she answers Jack of the Tump, only if he call her Great Jill of the Tump that bear me. Not if he cry by some newfangled mother of other Gentile, other Gentes over the flood, or if he uses the name of a different goddess from different tribe. So she needs to be called, related to specifically in this place, through this particular tradition. Gently she bends her head from far height. When tongue strings chime the name, she whispered on known sight, as between sister and brother at the time of beginnings, when the rapt bands are cast and the worst mewling is over, after the weaning and before the august initiation in the year of the becoming. When she and he, twixt the doorstone and the firestone, prefigure and puppet on the narrow floorstone, the world mask on the wide world floor. When she attentively changes her doll shift, let's pretend with solemnity, as rocking the womb gift. When he chivies the house bet with his toy sword, makes believe that the cat of the world falls to the pitiless bronze. Now what's being described there, in this is complicated language, is the divine presence listening when spoken to directly in our, from our own place of beginnings, in our own language. And what we're shown there is this, the sense of when she and he twixt the doorstone and the fire, prefigure and puppet on the narrow floorstone, the world mask on the wild floor, and we get changing the doll shift and then playing with a cat. Now this is the beginnings of the of our imagination. This is when we are small, when we are literally working with the, when we're very small, we work with these enormous things. This sense of here and there, outside and inside. We play these extraordinary games of the imagination. So as we enter into this place of beginnings, we also enter the place of our own beginnings, of our own imagination, of our own connection to here and there, inside, outside, stranger and friend, family and other. And one of the things that has been forgotten and is increasingly getting forgotten, and it's why historical consciousness is so important, is that we, if we lose that sense of connection with history, the connection with those who have gone before us, we lose the gifts that they can offer us. Of course, we can also become imprisoned in that, and that's the danger. The danger of history is we become lost in history and not accessible to the new. But the danger of losing history is to become swept away by the new without the holding, without the venerated trinkets, the sacred signa that remind us of what a human being is supposed to be in the world. That we, in a certain sense, that we stand in the world as the axis of the universe, as the place where the universal and the particular come together. We are the living, feel like, presence, the living vehicle through which the universal and the particular meet.
Thank you.
And the route into that, the route into being that, is not to go anywhere else other than to be present with yourself and your own history. And then your own history, your family's history, your culture's history. To then look within that for the tokens, the fertile tokens, the signa, the signs, the stories, the images, the prayers that bring us present to the to that moment of the interaction of the universal and the personal. Now what we've done, what we did in the meditation, both about this morning's meditation where we look at the house of life, where we look at a more elaborate meditation than what we've just done because we're looking at the shaping that we, it was like a whole set of different signa and ideas there, that from the tree of life to the kind of, to the aspects of Tantra, Bengal, Tantrism, to create a living shape that reminds us and holds us and connects us to who we more deeply are. When we enter the cave of the Red Lady of Pavilion, and we go through the goat's hole, we enter there into something that orients our attention into deep time. And this is really this whole function, the whole importance of the venerated trinkets, is they become doorways that connect us in directly into aspects of experience that are otherwise difficult to find. Enter the cave, when we contemplate the figure of the Red Lady or the Red Man, our attention is orientated back into that very ancient time. And the images that then emerge from that come out of that time. So hyenas come to see us. The mammoth mother becomes present to us. Now the importance of people like Alan Garner, like Tolkien, like David Jones, is they have, they're great companions on the way because they have worked on the way themselves and they leave behind them their own traces, their own images that enable us to find our own. It's not to become them, but through their helpfulness, finding our own route into this particular territory. And so one of the places, so if we go past all the complexity of this, where does this take us? It takes us into a sense of the direct encounter between ourselves and the universe. This sense of ourselves as both the access of the universe and as the doorway between the small world and the great world. And this sense of being connected to something, that it's connected to a speaking universe, an universe to which we can talk, and an universe that talks back to us. An universe where nothing is lost. Where we can visit the Red Man of Pavilion. And where he can, in a certain sense, communicate to us. Where hyenas can become alive again and show us something. But it involves a certain degree of trust, really, trust in ourselves and trust in that deeper kind of process. It also involves us noticing as we do this, noticing what happens when these great energies are misapplied. So if we move away from this profoundly interconnected thing, we end up into the sense of me, mine, and other. So the sense of I-ness, the sense of I-ness that is a sense of presence, a sense of here I am, just aware, awake in the world. Once I collapses into me, we move from subject to object, and we move into me and mine, and then the boundary between me and other and what is others. And that collapse from that direct experience takes us out of relationship and takes us into the world of blood and soil. The people that are my blood, the soil that is mine. So once we slip from I into me and mine, we then come into a really different shaping of the world. And we just have to simply have to look around the world. If you look at Ukraine, look at the Middle East at the moment, many of Sudan, many places. This sense of the collapse into me and mine and then fighting over what is mine is at the root, really, of all these kind of distortions. And then what happens is the venerated trinkets become these appallingly shadowy energies that drive disturbance, that drive separation. They no longer unite. They become, instead of something that reminds us, that brings us back into the contemplative place, into the temple whereby which we see each other, they become battering rams, they become weapons of division and destruction. One of the things I remember from when I was in South Africa, there was a whole number of Bushman caves. And so the cave I was hanging out in was one of the oldest of them. But there were later caves that really from the sort of 19th century. And one of the saddest of those caves was a description, was actually showing people, white men on horseback, riding down the Bushmen. And the Bushmen are no longer existing because they were killed in that area. And this is like one of the last, if you like, memorials by a Bushman artist in that area of the end of their people in that area. And in a way, that's the problem somewhere. And if we look at what happened in South Africa, if we look at the whole territory of apartheid, we look at the way in which Christian belief became, and not just there, of course, but in many places, instead of being a liberating gospel, a genuinely good news, becomes an oppressive and dangerous ideology through which you can justify doing terrible things. And in a way, that's the importance of this territory, the territory that we're looking at, really. If you hold it in the right way, it brings in new life, new energy. It's very powerful. Held in the wrong way, it brings in a lot of energy, but it brings in a lot of disturbing energy, a lot of justification for killing your neighbor and destroying your neighbor. Okay, we're just at our tea break, so let's have a break for half an hour, and then we'll return. So come back at 4 o'clock.
Are you going to say goodbye now?
Oh, you're going now, Andy, of course, yes. Have a nice time. You're going off to Bristol, isn't it? To Bristol you're going?
I am going to Bristol, yes.
Wonderful. Have a nice time.
After lunch, I hope.
See you after lunch tomorrow, then, Andy, hopefully. Okay, have a lovely evening, Andy. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.